the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Stefan Canfer returns to the show this week. We last spoke with him a few years ago when he published Somebody, his great biography of Marlon Brando. His new book, equally great, is Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Stefan Canfer has also written biographies of Groucho Marx and Lucille Ball. And he was for many years the film critic at Time magazine. Stefan Canfer, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
When you were at Time, you wrote a famous cover story that sort of defined the new era in movies, an era that is now thought of as sort of the second golden age of Hollywood, an era that was sadly short-lived. And at the beginning of your new book, you kind of lament the current state of the movies. Where are the movies now?
Well, for one thing, the old studios are gone. I mean, the idea of Warner Brothers, Paramount, Warner Brothers particularly important in Humphrey Bogart's career, but they're all gone because the back was broken when the Supreme Court said you can't own movie theaters anymore. So block booking was out, meaning that the studios couldn't just say, well, we're going to release a movie and everybody will go to see it this week because it's just a hit and everybody goes to movies every week. People don't go to the movies every week anymore. There are too many things calling, dividing their attention, you know, whether it's TiVo or television or their own iPods or whatever they are. There are just too many things that have removed movies from the center of our culture. And the other thing is that nobody serves an apprenticeship anymore. You have to make it big by the time you're 25 or you don't make it. And Humphrey Bogart was 42 before he became really famous. And then it was only the beginning of his career.
Oh, but there are still movie stars, and there's still movies. You think
there are, but rarely do you find a movie that's mature. I mean, this year is an exception. You have The King's Speech. It's about grown-ups. But Social Network is about kids. And for the most part, mall rats, young people, are the ones who go to see movies. And, of course, they want to see people their own age, or 18, 20, 25. They don't want to see an old man like Bogart, who's in his late 40s or early 50s. To them, that's not romantic. That's almost like their grandfathers. It's a different America now, and I think we're paying for it.
Well, I know you like to write about iconic figures, those
yes.
those that can be known by one name, like Bogey and Groucho and Lucy. What draws you to that particular? How come you don't want to write about Elijah Cook Jr.? Or
well, I would love to write if somebody would buy it. You could go on about Elijah Cook Jr. But the fact is that icons are a diminishing group, and I like to, quick before it melts, I like to write about them while they're still very much in the public consciousness. But actually, it's after I finished the Brando book, and after all, Brando died in 2000, and Humphrey Bogart died in 1957, and I seem to be going backwards.
Yeah.
But in fact, I was reading André Bazin, who is, was a very important French critic, Cahiers du Cinéma in the 50s. And he said that the difference between Brando and Bogart was that Brando, you never knew what was going to happen. You really never knew what he was going to give you from movie to movie, and sometimes from take to take in the same movie. And with Bogart, you always knew what you were going to get. And I think that's a very interesting distinction. Bogart was not a very versatile actor, but he convinced you that whatever part he was playing, it was not only important to him, but it was important to America. I mean, when he was in The Maltese Falcon, that seemed to be the American gritty character, the American male about to go to war. Casablanca, America had gone to war, and we all wanted to be Bogart, or the people who were around then wanted to be Bogart. And when you see him even now, that kind of cool treatment of women. He's attracted to them and they're attracted to him, but at the same time he can relinquish them if he has to, as he relinquishes Mary Astor and he relinquishes Ingrid Bergman and many others. That's just a part of his persona that I think people, particularly undergraduates of the 50s and 60s, just adored. You know, it's part of what he is. And when he got older, he did stretch a bit and showed that he could do comedy and showed that he could be a romantic lead, that he could do something about character leads, something that's almost impossible to imagine now, that he could play a character of maturity, shall we say, and still be attractive.
Yeah, well, you talk about his, maybe he's not quite as versatile as Cagney, who could veer to musicals or westerns.
For one thing, Cagney could hoof.
Right.
No question about it, he could sing. And Bogart couldn't do either of those.
But you know, and I think Bogart is one of those actors that people like Jimmy Stewart or John Wayne or Henry Fonda, that people love to say, oh, you know, he's always the same, he's just himself. But when you examine the arc of his career, as you do so well in Tough Without a Gun, you can really see how varied the roles were and how unlike himself they were.
Well, they were very much unlike himself, except that there's a feeling usually of integrity that he presents on screen, and that really was what he was like as a man. I mean, he paid his father's debts. He was from a once wealthy family, and they blew it all on bad investments, and Bogart was not famous yet when he paid off his father's debt. His father was a surgeon who had come to really to nothing and was a drug addict, and he paid off every dime, and that's the sort of man he was. He did not judge very well in his marriages. He had four marriages, and only when he met Lauren Bacall did it become permanent, and he had children with them. But nonetheless, he was the kind of person who is sort of, you can push him only so far and no further, and that is the American character as it saw itself in those movies. But he was versatile more than one thinks. If you see, for example, the Maltese Falcon at one end and, say, African Queen at the other end, when he's funny and playing with a different kind of costume and falling in love at a very late age, then you can see how he did stretch quite a bit and how he always was rather ambitious. For example, in when he plays Captain Queeg in the Caine Mutiny,
yeah,
that is a very ungracious role. I mean, he plays a paranoid in it, and he breaks down on the stand, and you find him sympathetic because, as the novelist Herman Welk said, and playwright, that he was on guard when the rest of us, meaning America, were, you know, playing in college or fooling around or doing what they did. And yet, when he breaks down on the stand, he really breaks down. It's like watching Nixon, very much so. Sometimes when I see that movie, I think I'm watching Frost Nixon. It's a really good study of a paranoid, and it was done because Bogart really wanted it so badly he took a pay cut to do it. So those are the things you do see about a rather more ambitious actor than he let on.
It's interesting, too, when you talk about the integrity of his roles, because that only occurs after 1941. I mean, think of him in Angels with Dirty Faces. He's the most weaselly weasel that ever lived.
Well, he said, you know, in all those roles where he's playing second banana to George Reft and Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson and the others, he always gets killed. He's so bad he has to get knocked off the years of the code. So they have to knock him off.
Yeah.
And he said in those years, which was the years of his apprenticeship, he said that he spent more time writhing around on the floor than he did standing up, because he was always killed. And it wasn't until George Reft turned down a role, he said, this is not a George Reft movie, it's not important, it's been made twice before, I don't want to be in it. And besides, the director is his kid, 34 years old, John Huston, who needs it? And he walked away from it, and that was Bogart's real break. It was The Maltese Falcon, and he showed that he could carry a movie.
Yeah. We're talking with Stefan Kanfer, and his new book is called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. You know, I was thinking about also in terms of integrity in The Treasure of Sierra Madre, one of Bogart's great roles. That's a part I don't think Clark Gable would ever have played. I don't think Gable never wanted to be seen in such an unseemly way.
Yes, for one thing, he is overtaken by greed. It's gold fever. He also gets decapitated. Oh, you don't see the decapitation, but it's very strongly suggested. And yet, you can't keep your eyes off him. I don't think that anybody else would have taken that role. I think the reason he was drawn to it was, well, it's a good story. It's also John Huston. And anything John wanted, Humphrey found himself doing. For example, you know, I mean, that role is very interesting for two reasons. For one thing, he doesn't carry the whole film. It's really a love story of John and Walter. I mean, it's the son loving the father and making him the centerpiece. It's not a Bogart movie. It's really a Huston movie. But Bogart's so strong, you can't keep your eyes off him. And there's a great story. It's not about Bogart, but Bogart said, it's bad enough to have one Huston in your life. To have two is murder. Because he, you know, Walter really was
upstaging it.
And many times, overacting.
Yeah.
And although he's wonderful in the movie, they had to cut a lot out. There's a famous scene where he's dancing.
Yeah.
You know, and making fun of Bogart and Tim Holt and just dancing. Two shoe clerks, the Midnight, you know, and all that stuff. And he did it. He was so over the top that the stagehands were looking the other way, and Bogart didn't know what to do. Everybody was wringing their hands. And when it stopped, Houston, Walter, who was very pleased with himself, looked up at John Houston, who was on a boom, and said, "Well, what'd you think of it, son?" And John Houston looked down and said, "A little too much Walter Houston, Dad," which is such a great, it's a wonderful put down. And then Walter, you know, got better at it. And I think that was because Bogart was essentially a generous actor, that he was willing to be in a film that was not about him, where he died before the end, because he knew he could get a lot out of it, and because he loved working with John Huston, and he's terrific in it, and it's a terrific movie. And when I saw it the other day, I hadn't seen it in quite a while, I noted something that I don't think anybody's ever commented on, and that is there are a lot of scenes in Crystal shot in Mexico that are in Spanish. There are no subtitles. If you don't get it, you just have to go along with it. When the villagers talk, it's all in Spanish. When the Indians talk, it's all in Spanish. There's a little bit with Alfonso Bedoya, the famous line, I don't have to show you our stinking badges. But for the most part, it's Spanish, and that's the way John Huston wanted it. There's a lot of integrity in that movie.
Speaking of Warner Brothers, the studio that Bogart made by far the most movies, Warner Brothers, he probably would never have become a star if he'd been at MGM, because the kinds of movies that Bogie, rose to fame on are movies that MGM would never have made.
That's an excellent point, and there's another point, too, and that is Warner's, which love to do the underside of America. They love to do criminals, and, you know, I'm a prisoner of chain gang, and all that. But they really knew how to light black and white movies. They really did. And John Huston said that if you saw Bogart on the street, you'd think he's an intelligent-looking, pleasant-looking man, but that's all. But when you saw him lit with those cameras and the way in which they did that chiaroscuro lighting, something happened to his face which was almost noble. And I think that if Bogart had come up, let's say at MGM, with Technicolor, he would not have made it. He needed black and white to establish that face. And also the other part of him is that, you know, he and a lot of other stars like Cary Grant and not many others came up through radio. So they really had voices. And, of course, it's a field day for impressionists. You don't see impressionists to Brad Pitt or Tobey Maguire or Christian Bale. They didn't do them because they don't have a strong vocal personality that I think you had to have in those days at Warner Brothers.
Not only that, but I guess, you know, if you look at, say, Tobey Maguire's career in the last, you know, 5 years, he's made maybe 3 pictures, whereas in a 5-year span, Bogart made about 50 pictures.
Right. Even in the latter days, like when he won the Academy Award for African Queen, he made 4 movies that year. I mean, he was always working, and people don't realize that the old pros really worked. I mean, they didn't just punch a clock when it felt like it, but they were studio personnel, and in the old days you worked because you either worked or you didn't eat. And even later on, I think, Humphrey Bogart, from his theater days, and he was in 19 plays before he ever came to Hollywood, learned that in his mind, there are only 2 kinds of actors, probably 2 kinds of people generally, professionals and bums. And he just was not going to be a bum, and he'd rather overwork and be a professional than laze around and be a bum, because he really thought, having seen his example of his father and a lot of other people in Hollywood, they could all go through your fingers in a minute if you weren't careful.
Just bear with me and talk to me about Clark Gable for a minute. Gable, who was sort of Bogart's opposite over at MGM, mm-hmm. also a fine actor. Those two never work together. Bogey says in your book, the only way that the Academy Award for Best Actor would be fair is if everybody played Hamlet.
That's right. He felt, you know, if somebody's in a musical and somebody else is in a drama and somebody else is in a comedy and they're all vying for the same statuette, it was very unfair. And in a way, he's right. But, you know, I remember Lee Marvin, I once saying, that's not your best performance when he won an Oscar.
Yeah.
For Cat Ballou, and he said, "Yeah, but that's the track we all run on," and it's true.
Yeah,
I mean, you'd like to change the Hollywood rules, and they change them from year to now. They have more candidates, but nonetheless, they're never going to have everybody play Hamlet and judge that. It's not going to happen. Gable was a very different kind of actor, and masculine in that way, that old-fashioned masculinity. And he did have a voice that everybody now listen here, Scarlett. You know, everybody imitated that voice.
Yeah,
but he. I don't know, there's something, he's up there, he's the king, but, you know, there's a reason why Humphrey Bogart was named by AFI, the American Film Institute, the number one American cinema actor of all time. There is a reason for that. I don't think that many men identified with Gable, except early on when he didn't wear an undershirt, and so no American man wore an undershirt after that. Just knocked the hell out of the undershirt industry. But generally speaking, I think more men would identify, particularly today, with Humphrey Bogart, who doesn't play in period pieces. Bogart is the here and now. You know, when he was in Westerns, he was awful. But usually he's a contemporary figure. And Gable is very often not. I mean, Gable is often put in other roles. And he doesn't seem to have aged as well, I don't think, or lasted as well. Although you don't have Gable festivals the way you have Bogart festivals.
Yeah, the Bogart boom that happened in the 1960s. I think that's Life magazine had a cover story, the Bogart boom. I remember that quite well. And
that's the astonishing, it really is an astonishing afterlife, because usually when an actor dies, there's an efflorescence for a while and then the fade out. And Bogart got stronger, in part, I think, because of the, you know, he was sort of adopted as a quasi-hero by the Harvard undergraduates in the 50s, who were overworked and sort of identified with him just about the time of the birth of cool. So he was Mr. Cool, like kind of what Miles Davis was for the Horn. That persisted through the 50s. Then in the 60s, everything got very relevant, and nobody talked about Bogart. And then Woody Allen, at the late 70s, wrote and directed a film called Play It Again, Sam, which is a misquote from Casablanca, but which is very effective and has a Bogart imitator in it telling Woody how to act with women. How close should I be? The length of your lips. You know, lines like that. And it just put Bogart back, his piece back on the board. That's never gone away since.
And the films, you know, the films are all around, and they're all, I mean, I think he has more Blu-ray discs than most actors of his era.
I would dare say that everybody in the world pretty much has seen, even kids, have seen Casablanca. And some people have seen it 20 times, and if it were on tonight, they'd see it again, and so would I. Because it's just so full of great lines, and because, you know, it had a pretty good director, Michael Curtiz. It had terrific co-stars and a wonderful cast when everybody had a real accent, but it's a Bogart movie. You don't think of it as an Ingrid Bergman movie. It's a Bogart movie.
My wife asked me, you've seen this picture so many times, you can recite it. Why are you watching it again? I said, well, you know, there's a lot of great songs. You know all the words. It doesn't mean you don't want to hear them again.
Well, good point. Yes, you've heard Sinatra once. But I think it's more than that. I mean, that's part of it, is that you love the lines and love it. But I keep finding new things in it. I watch it again and again. Now I watch what Peter Lorre is doing, you know, and his biographer said he made a roll out of scraps, and it's true. It's not a big part, but you can't keep your eyes off him. And the fact that it was made during the Holocaust, when so many of those actors had relatives in Europe, and, you know, here's Conrad Veidt, who was condemned to play Nazis all the time, who ran from the Nazis and had a Jewish wife, but, you know, there he is playing that part and being ultra-convincing in it. All the part, Maurice Dalion, all those real accents that I think gave it a texture that's unmatched. Usually you have, first of all, you have Koreans playing Japanese because they couldn't have any Japanese actors in those World War II movies, and then you had genuine European actors playing parts of refugees, and they knew what it was like to be a refugee. So it had all of that animation and power behind and conviction behind those lines.
We're talking with Stefan Canfer, and his new book is called Tough Without a Gun. It's a biography of Humphrey Bogart, and I love the dust cover. On the front is Bogart all in black, and on the back is Bogart all in white.
Yes, and the studio shots in there—they're wonderful because the white one really does show you he was quite a handsome man and something of a pretty boy earlier on in his stage career. I mean, he was considered a young sprig when he first started in the theater. It's only later that he got this persona that we now accept as D. Bogart.
In your book about Marlon Brando, we were talking about how you sort of came to understand Brando as being mentally ill, and you know, it was remarkable that he made those few great movies that he made. It was remarkable that he got them made at all. Bogart's personality was pretty different. He seemed pretty well-adjusted guy.
Well, he had never gone to a psychiatrist, and he was sort of proud of that, and the fact that he'd stayed on top in a very tough profession. But I think he had his problems. Having four wives, each one of them an actress, and each one of them until until Lauren Bacall, a rather bad choice, Mayo Matheux, who was his third wife, was crazy, and she was an alcoholic and stabbed him in the back once with a knife. And that was hushed up, but it's a true story.
That's
and
not good.
You know, I think that he had mother problems, and I don't mean that in a kind of, you know, deep Freudian or paperback Freudian way. His mother was rather cold, very, very successful woman and illustrator, but the children never called her mother. They called her Maud, and she never hugged anybody. And I think that he had a very strange view of women. I think he just blundered into a lot of things he shouldn't have blundered into, because he never really had a very good upbringing in that sense. He had a macho upbringing, and his father was someone that he, I think, really did look up to, but I don't think he wanted to follow his father's footsteps and become a doctor. But overall, he was certainly a lot healthier and balanced, more balanced than a guy like Brando. I mean, he liked his booze. Unfortunately, he also liked his cigarettes, and I think they killed him. And when I watch him now, I think, stop doing that. Don't, you know, you can't stop him. But everybody smoked then. That was kind of the American way. The camphor tobacco theory of World War II is he wouldn't have won it without tobacco. You had Roosevelt smoking a cigarette holder. Of course, you had Churchill with a cigar, Stalin with a pipe. You know, it was only Hitler that didn't smoke. So it was a very different world. Anyway, I think Bogart was very close to an alcoholic. Not over the line, but very close. Drank all the time, and even after his cancer operation, he kept drinking. So that was the flaw. I don't think he could get away from it.
I couldn't believe it in your book when, after his cancer operation, he resumed smoking.
Well, they do. I mean, I think it's probably the toughest habit to kick. I smoked briefly when I was in the Army and then gave it up. It was not a big thing in my life, but my father was a three-pack-a-day guy. That's what they did. I always think of my father when I think of Bogart, because that's what they did then. And it's just such a shame, because, I mean, I'm not sure that Bogart would have gone on to make many, many more great films, but he probably would have had another African Queen in him if he had been healthy.
Well, he was only 57 or something, right?
Yeah, he was 57 when he died, and he was dying for a couple of years, so you really can say that, you know, when you look at The Harder They Fall, in which he has a bad toupee, most of his toupees are quite good, you didn't know, but this one you can tell, and it's a movie exposing the boxing business. You never knew the boxing was corrupt, did you? You know, that sort of thing. It was a necessary film to make.
I like it. I think it's a good picture.
I like the guy who plays the Primo Carnera role.
Yeah, he's great.
It's fascinating to watch. And the two of them, because you know, Bogart is small compared to him, that's a very interesting contrast, because Bogart holds his own. He can fill up a screen with the same skills a big man can, for different reasons.
Well, you know, I was thinking about The Desperate Hours. That's a film I like a lot. You're not that crazy about it, but I like it a lot. And one of the things I think is interesting is if you put it side by side with Duke Mantee, The Petrified Forest, he's playing essentially the same role, but he plays them completely differently. They're very different people.
Well, it's interesting because on Broadway, Paul Newman played it, and you know, there's quite a bit of difference in the age and the style of those actors. So Bogart made it his own by doing a grown-up version of Paul Newman, but doing Duke Mantee as he might have been had he survived. And that's a good point. I mean, it is the same role, but the guy is a very different kind of guy, and Bogart is a different kind of man for playing it. I think that was the sort of thing that attracted him, essentially, because it was not a hard role for him to play. But he gave it a spin. I think the film is a little too expected, and some of the lines don't work. That's why I don't like it. But I love anything that gives him a chance to do his thing. So perhaps the movie is better than I have written about. But it's certainly not one of my top 10 Bogart movies.
What about Bogart's intellectual life? Was he a reader and an educated man?
Well, that's a good point. Because he never wanted people to know that. He loved the whole tough guy persona. It got him a lot of jobs. But in fact, he was not only a good reader and a close reader, but he knew a lot of swaths of Shakespeare. He loved Bach. He loved Debussy. All of that was private. It's not that he wanted people to think he was illiterate, but I don't think he wanted people to know how intellectually inclined he was. But the real intellectual property he had was that he was a great chess player. He was one of those people who, at some time in the 20s, when he and his first wife didn't have any money, he would go down to these chess emporia and play chess for money, and they'd make enough to pay the rent. and it's pretty good. And he played to the end of his life. He was playing chess and very proud of his game. This is something that remained hidden from the public.
Was his background on Broadway helpful to him in terms of being able to know his lines and that sort of thing?
I think so, because he got into acting because he didn't have anything else to do. He got out of the Navy and had his lip busted by a prisoner, and that gave him that odd, stiff diction that he had, along with the musical voice. And he just fell into acting because he had a friend whose father was a famous producer. And he took these roles. I mean, the first role he ever played was a Japanese butler. You can imagine how he must have been in that. And he was terrified, and he, you know, didn't know what to do in front of audiences or where to face anybody, upstage, downstage. He was just an amateur. But he was what was called a sprig, as I said. He was a good-looking young man, and somebody in those days had to move the cast around. You know, a big cast on Broadway now is 5 people, but in the 20s it was 25 people, and somebody had to come in and say, "Tennis, anyone," so they could get those people off the stage and then change the scenery. And he was the guy, and he did that for a long time, just being a sprig, until somebody said, "Wait a minute, this guy, something, people watch him when he does it. There's something else. Let's cast him against the part." And that's when he played Duke Mantee in the Petrified Forest and electrified the audiences, because they had never seen it. They just thought he was a pretty boy. All of a sudden, an unshaven and terrifying figure with a gun came on stage, and with that voice, and it transfixed audiences to such a great degree that Leslie Howard said, "You know, you have to come with me when we make this." And he was the producer as well as the star of the play. "You have to come to Hollywood and make this with me." And Bogart thought that was his guarantee of success, only to read in Variety that the part was going to be played by Edward G. Robinson. And it was only because Edward G. Robinson at that moment chose to ask for a salary hike, and Jack Warner didn't like to be pushed around by actors whom he, you know, felt were worse than cattle. You know, he called writers schmucks with Underwood, so you can imagine what he thought of actors. And he wasn't going to be pushed around by Eddie Robinson, so he said, "Get lost. Go find something else to do." And he said, "I'll pick this guy, Bogart. I don't know much about him, but Leslie likes him, and he was good on Broadway. Give him a shot." And that's really the real start of Bogart's beginning career. He didn't do very well in that, as we've discussed, in the first half of that career. He made quite a few films, upwards of 30 films before he ever got started playing Sam Spade in The Maltese Falcon and High Sierra, and convincing audiences that he was more than just a gunsel to be knocked off.
But a great leading man, in fact.
He became a leading man, but only because breaks seemed to go his way, because George Raft said, "This is not an important movie." Things like that always happened to him. And they were, you know, Raft later on, looking at Bogart, said, "There, but for the grace of me, go I." You know, they all sort of got out of his way without realizing they were doing it.
Well, Groucho, Lucy, Bogey, what's next, Stephen Kanfer?
I'll tell you. That's one of these. I'm going to tell you what Billy Wilder said, because his answer is always the best. Uh-huh. And after he made any movie, people always came to him and said, "Mr. You know, Billy, what are you going to do next?" And he had a standard answer, which was the most evasive and funny answer I've ever heard from him. He said, "My next movie is going to be about the human condition." So I thought, that's it. My next movie will be about the human condition until I can get a contract from Knopf, and then I'll tell you.
Well, I hope when the Human Condition book comes out, you'll come back and join us on From the Book.
Oh, it'll be my pleasure. Anytime.
Stephen Kanfer, one of our favorite schmucks with Underwood, and his book is called...
Thank you so much, Mr. Warner.
Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back again next week. And also that you'll check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our guest, Stephen Kanfer. His book is called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. There'd be no From the Bookshelf without you, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.